Welcome back to this month's Real Estate Roundtable. I'm Andreas Senni. Joining us for this month's roundtable, Saul Klein, Becca Carlson, and Jonathan Stein, our friend from Inland Real Estate. Darren Hayes is away, as well as Chris Abel. But with us, guests will come in. We'll start off our
show. Yeah.
There he is. I said earlier, technology problems only happen to technology. The show, as always, is a three-part series, three-part segments in every show. Step one is the introduction for all you new listeners tuning in for the first time. Who we are, what we do, our day-to-day, where we come from, our backgrounds. Two is the buzz, what's happening in the market today from our respective sides of the industry. As you know, tuning in, we're cybersecurity, real estate, marketing, as well as data. And institutional real estate agency Jonathan Stein today with England. And then step three of the show, what can you do right now to make a major impact for your business, for your customers? With that, Saul Klein, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? Who are you? What do you do? And we'll walk our way through this.
I am Saul Klein. I do as little as possible these days, huh? But I've been in the real estate business for about 45 years, and I served on the first Realtor.com team that put together Realtor.com and did some work with the National Association of Realtors, creating online education and designations, and worked to create the opt-out syndication and distribution of listing information to companies such as Zillow and Trulia. So I was instrumental in moving the MLS from the book to the internet. And from the internet to portal, my theme when I was doing that a number of years ago was distribution trumps destination. And so we've been working on that theme and working around that theme. And now I consult the real estate industry. I'm particularly interested in data use, blockchain, how associations and realtors are going to adopt and adapt to the changes that many of them don't see coming.
Love it. And you've been talking these changes for years. Since when did Vrin come out? What was the year?
Well, I was on that. I was the first person that they hired after the initial team. It was 1995, and I was the vice president. That's an interesting story. I was the vice president of marketing for the Realtors Information Network. Walt Bukowski and I brought Richard Jansen to the Vrin board of directors, which was Vrin was a wholly owned subsidiary of NAR at the time, with this idea of putting listings on the internet. And it was a time like this, there was a lot of change, but we went out and we got contracts and created Realtor.com. And so I participated on that team and was involved in all of that, have been till about 5 years ago when two of the companies that we'd built, we'd sold them, and it gave us time to start doing some other things and spending time just kind of observing the industry again. But that was an interesting time. That was a fun time, and that was a one piece, and a couple of generations later on the internet, we ended up with listing data not only going to Realtor.com, but through syndication going out to many different points. And then there's a question came up around data rights management, tools to manage those data rights, value of data. How can you track the value of data that's used in different places? And so there's all of that's now coming to a head. And it's coming to a head on the real estate side and on the mortgage side. And so it's a pretty exciting time to be in the real estate business, I think.
I love it. And with that, not just the real estate business, the capital markets business. Becca Carlson, welcome again. Where do you come from? What do you do in your day-to-day for the real estate business and the industry itself?
I feel like my entire professional life has been commercial real estate, which is a really amazing thing to say since I didn't intend to go into commercial real estate. I don't have a family history in real estate. And actually, I can attribute that very much to Jonathan Stein, who's here today. So I met Jonathan at my very first ICSE conference in Las Vegas, and that was 17 years ago now because my daughter is 17 and I had an eight-week-old baby at home. And I had just been in the industry maybe a year working in marketing at my old firm. And Jonathan just warmly embraced me and just welcomed and has been a mentor of mine since. And so here I am, 4 years into having my own company as that is a marketing firm, and I get to work with owners and developers and property managers and brokers and people within the industry that I love that do all sorts of amazing things, and I get to tell their stories all across the country. And I actually can attribute very much of that to Jonathan, who's with us today. So all things come full circle, and those relationships that we build in the industry and the friendships that we make over time impact our entire lives.
Absolutely. And funny enough, everyone on today's call, Darren and Chris aside, couldn't make it. We're all licensed brokers, and Jonathan Stein, who in my world needs no introduction, but made a huge influence on my life when he entered it as one of the best networks I've ever met. If Sal is the data guy, and that's true, we know that to be true, then Jonathan Stein is the networking guy, the guy out there at the shows, broker out there moving around. But Jonathan, tell me a little more about your background, how you ran into us, what you're doing now, and then I'll give a short 2 cents on who I am and jump into part two segment.
All right. Well, thank you. First of all, Becca and Andres, you're both too kind. So my name is Jonathan Stein, and I am officially the president of Inland Real Estate Commercial Brokerage, which is a small boutique firm with Inland. Inland started over 50 years ago with the founder, Daniel Goodwin, and three of his partners who are all school teachers. All of them are still working, three full-time, one kind of part-time, 5 and 6 days a week because they love it. So I was a school teacher also. That's how I got involved. I came on the board a few years later. Inland is an incubator of financial products for investors is basically what it is. And we've owned all different classes of real estate except probably office. And our biggest business right now is DST 1031. That is a driving force in our business, and it's really doing extremely well. But we've got other companies, other entities out there, two banks, a development company, a mortgage company, and we've got subsidiaries of those companies like residential loans under the bank. So it's a pretty diversified company. But as I said, DST 1031 is the driving force in that, and I can explain that a little bit later if anybody wants, or go from there. And also Inland Green Capital, which is a company that provides up to 100% financing for any sustainable energy-saving commodity that you want to put on either new developments or existing. And I can chat a little bit about that later on, too. So that gives you a whole perspective, I believe, of Inland, which is basically an incubator of financial products, all in real estate, commercial real estate.
I love it. The Inland family companies, group of companies, is wide and broad across its depth all over the U.S. I was lucky enough to get through different tech involvements, different tech platforms. But speaking of meeting, and Saul, you touched on this before, NAR's coming to California for its big convention. I've got three past presidents of different NAR boards here on call, I believe. Actually, I'm the only non-president on this call. This is okay. But networking and data and people. So you've got it. The country's open. You've got people coming. Your car wash is thriving. Jonathan, you missed that joke on the last show. But I'm assuming the car wash is still thriving. Are you going to get up and go to the show? It's in your backyard. Networking. What is happening in the networking?
So well, you know, networking has been a very valuable piece of my career. And because I have this philosophy, don't burn any bridges. People say, what would you say? I say, don't burn any bridges. Because it's all about relationships. It's all about people. And for the most part of my career, the way that you built relationships was in person. And then in the 90s, we got involved in a little bit, a couple of new ways to be able to interact with email and websites, but COVID's really accelerated now ways to network and ways to engage. And so to me, relationships are built on engagement. And there are many different ways to engage people. And social media now today gives us different ways to engage people. And now we can have minute micro engagements, right? A like or a smile. So there's many. And each of those things, while they don't seem like much, to the person who you do that to, they see it. And so it's got, now we have new tools. But still, if there's an opportunity to meet with people face-to-face, particularly in the real estate industry, it makes sense to try to get out and meet with them face-to-face. Now, I would also say that I've gotten lazy over the last couple of years. That might have more to do with getting old than just, you know, but do I really want to get on airplanes and fly around anymore? I'm real happy with developing new ways to continue to develop relationships online. But now that NAR is in my backyard, yeah, I'm going to go down there. I'm already setting appointments with people who I'm going to see. I haven't seen them in years, a couple of years now. And part of my life was often going to many events, probably like you, Jonathan, at many events, seeing people who you only saw at events, who you could do business with and have a relationship that you saw them once a year or twice a year. And you did that over many, many years and developed friendships and trust and confidence. And it's all relationships. On the data side, well, yeah, people then keep track of this today, right? And there are ways to keep track of the people, and you can now keep track of more. We used a Rolodex when I first started, right? And that's the way you kept track of different things about people, so you could remember birthdays and different things that would help you to engage, because each engagement strengthened the bond a little bit more. And so we all became good at engaging, and we all became good engaging personally. And again, over the last couple of years, we've had the opportunity to do so on, digitally, and that's changing. And of course, we're used to doing it like we are now, but on the forms that we're using, either our cell phones or our computers. But that'll change, and the people will be using. Wasn't it just the other day? Facebook changed their name, and they're getting into just a little bit more in depth into and change in the way that people are going to socially interact. And we're going to see more of that kind of thing. So it's relationships. It's finding new tools to develop the relationship, to maintain that connection, even though you're not around. But when you're not close, physically close, but when you can be physically close, I think there's still a value in that. And absolutely. Even after all this COVID stuff's over, I think you're going to see people are going to want to get back together.
Well, I think you could even argue that COVID helped prove how much we want to be face-to-face with our peers, with our colleagues. Maybe not all the time. Maybe I want some nicer thing in my office. So you've got NARS coming back, and that's Jonathan Stein and I bumped in at an ICSC show. I think that's where we first met, actually, or it might have been at Inland. But he's the only guy I had to chase after at ICSC. Which was a big thing, because I move fast at shows. Jonathan, what's going on in your networking world in Chicago? For those who don't know, Inland is based in
you're absolutely right. Everyone's right. This is a relationship business without question, number one. And it's also a contact sport, in my opinion. The most people you can touch out there, the better. Unfortunately, I haven't embraced the technology world that we're in now with Facebook and Twitter and all that, and I'm still stuck the old-fashioned way. So what's going on now, and I forgot to mention, Inland has done five REITs, public REITs out there. They took private REITs that they took public on the New York Stock Exchange in its history. But anyway, as far as specifically now, one of the other things I do is source self-storage deals. And so I've been to conferences. I'm going to one Big Sky in January and making contacts there for people who want to sell either institution, big portfolios, or in the right position, the monpas. And what we do with that is package them up and sell them to a network of network of broker dealers with their registered reps that are around the country. So investors go in there, Inland manages the entire process, and it's clipping coupons for the final investor, for the investor there, so he can reap the benefit of having professional management doing everything for him and be diversified and own a piece of real estate, whether it's a 1031 or it's just a straight investment. The other thing is we have a fund doing manufactured housing. The old classic Sam Zell model, if you just wear the skirt around and around the country. This is a huge industry. People don't realize that there's like 23 million people live in what you consider a trailer park or manufactured housing, as it's referred to. So there's a big conference. The biggest one of the year is going to be in Chicago this Tuesday and Wednesday, actually. And I'll be there with others from the Inland team to try to make connections and keep buying. And again, this is a fund different than the DST, but the bottom line is people with a good investment with a solid 50-year-old plus company. I hope you guys don't think I'm sounding too much like a commercial here, but that's what's going on.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
No, I think it's really a great point, and it's really like shared equity in a way. What we're talking about is people getting together one way or another. You mentioned REITs. That's big time. That's corporate side, right? And that's publicly traded kind of stuff. And then there are other ways that people can invest, and they're like limited partnerships and LLCs and those sorts of things. And then you mentioned really specific kind of things, that things are typically revenue producing, like mini warehouses, and people see these everywhere. So they're great cash producers, and so you accumulate them, you put them into a structure, and what is, do you like use a limited partnership kind of structure, and then, or an LLC, how is it structured? And then you offer it to multiple people who would be interested in that, and in this case, it's income generated. It's not really growth, it's really more income.
Correct.
Coupon, say.
Correct. We did the old limited partnerships, if you're familiar with, until 1985, when the tax laws all changed and everything blew up. We did the private REITs, which turned public, giving people liquidity on their investment. Once it went on the New York Stock Exchange, they could sell it the next day. And the structure that we use for our 1031s is called DST, Delaware Statutory Trust 1031. It's a securitized product. The investor has no real say-so into how it's run or anything like that, because it is a security. And, you know, people have owned the property for 30 years. They've got a few million-dollar profit. They don't want to give all that to the IRS. So they defer it. It's deferred. Sometimes the government confuses it. It's not avoidance. It's deferring it. And that generates all kinds of positive economic growth for the country, because, you know, people, now they're going to fix up the property,
right,
on their own. Then they put money into it with new carpet and bathrooms and whatever on it. So the government, as you may know, has been trying to eliminate this or cap it for, frankly, I think it must be at least 10 years. It started with Obama, and it's gotten more accelerated as of late, because they just simply don't understand the process, and they think they're going to get all this tax gain to pay for all the crazy spending plans that the Democrats and the socialists have.
Well, you know, I had it's real interesting. I had a Series 7, Series 24, Series 63 securities licenses. And so in addition to my real estate and property management business, I had a tax practice, and I sold securities to people. I used to love to go to the securities conventions and to look at all the different products that different wholesalers would be offering, or the different syndicators or promoters would be offering, that gave people opportunities to invest in things that they typically wouldn't be able to invest in. Walnut groves, or car washes, or, you know, just different specialty areas that are revenue generating, that got put together, put in a structure. People are, and the definition of security, right, where you hands off, you have nothing to say, you just collect the money. And yeah, that was a great business years ago, and it's great to see people do it. New forms of ownership, but same thing, right? People build wealth in real estate, or they build income in real estate.
Right. Yeah, I've got 22 62 and a 63 actually also, being in wineries and all kinds of stuff that is out there. Yeah. But it's strictly real estate. Yeah.
Well, let's not forget oil mining, right? So if we want to go down this road, which we touched on last month. Yep. But you know what I noticed as we're talking about this? You went to, Saul said, I went to these conventions to see what to invest in, to see what was happening, understand the pulse of the business. And even now today, you're doing trading that. You're focused on data, but you're still going to conventions. So the relationships had to survive. Not only did it survive, it's got to get back in its groove. People talking to people, seeing what's out there. I think, and just Jonathan, he touched on it. He said Facebook becoming metaverse. Facebook wants to create a whole virtual world. We're not even going to leave our houses. We're going to go on our computer. If you haven't heard the news, and that's how we'll interact virtually. And I have seen a few brokers, larger nationals, even try to implement virtual worlds for their people, for their employees. Virtual desk, virtual conference room, virtual hallways. You can eavesdrop on your colleague in a hallway. Believe it or not, I don't know how many people actually log into this thing, and I'm not going to name this brokerage, but we are back talking to one another. Zoom, hop in, went from 4 employees to over 1,000. It's huge value. It is the fastest growing startup, I believe, in the last 5 years, thanks in part largely to COVID, in part because of the data. People needed to find a way to get together across long distances because they were lazy or they just wanted to interact better. COVID happened and all of a sudden, everybody had to figure it out, which really pushed us forward. And ICSC and R had to figure out how, and even NYCAR, to figure out how to have people meet. NYCAR was actually an early adopter of Hopin, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, Zoom is for meetings. Hopin is for virtual conferences. It is a startup about the size of Zoom that isn't as well known, at least not as broadly known, that does just that. It's a virtual conference. You can go see a stage. You can go see the wares, an alley, the deal making. And for me, getting back to the people, I think I will travel. Not only would I travel, once it's safe to travel, I think that when we're at these shows, we'll find that our connection with people is stronger because we haven't seen them.
But you know what? Part of this is generational, right? So while we see things a certain way and we prefer things a certain way, there's no guarantee that the next generation, and I'm saying like from wherever we might sit, right, has different habits, and, right? And like some people won't. If you want to communicate with them, I have to text them because I know they don't answer the phone. So there are different ways to do things. So people learn to engage in new ways. And so if you look at where Facebook is going, there was a company called Second Life 15 years ago that in Coldwell Banker had an office. And so people are experimenting and changing it. But now, you know, there's big money behind it. And it won't be everybody that does it all at once. Just like when you have a revitalization or redevelopment in a city, it doesn't happen all at once. It takes 50 years to see the results. And so these things, we see them, we hear about them, they're news. And because we don't hear about them or see them for a while, doesn't mean they're not continuing to happen, right? And they're growing and they're changing. So more of these digital opportunities, and there are more people who are wrapped up. And when I see younger people, I think they're more inclined to do things a different way. If for no other reason, it's a different way.
That's our point. Closing the loop on the security side and the networking side, my question, which is a broad question for this group, I think, do you see the intangible virtual world as assets, real estate assets, securities? Has that I know we didn't get to the market side of this yet, and we probably talk all day about how Facebook has to change their name in marketing aside, but so on your side of the fence, looking at securities, and Jonathan Stein, I don't know if Inland's thought of this or looked at it, but I know Nike and others are already putting patents on their product, on their brands, so they don't show up in the digital world. There's a concern. There's a value in the digital world, as Saul just said, because Facebook now highlighted it, it was there. what do we do with your electronic, your data, your properties in the metaverse? I mean, has anything come up on your side of the fence yet at Inland about electronic fungibles, non-fungibles? Excuse me. Correct me if I'm wrong, Saul. I might have flooded that word.
No, NFTs.
Non-fungible tokens. Yeah. Non-fungible token and ownership. The real next generation.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. It's a whole other conversation.
So yeah, you're talking about, and it's an existing technology, right? Talking about blockchain, and you're talking about all the advantages that come with that. And then how might that fit into the real estate world? Two different things. One thing is just the whole real estate transaction is just a series of mini transactions, right? From start to finish. It's just
interactions.
Like, right? All these interactions and all these transactions. So to what degree can those things be put in a block or in a technology that allows all the things that have to be done? And so I see at some point all this process of writing, of, you know, creating documentation, recording documentation. When I go online to trade stocks, I can hit a button and boom, I own IBM stock, right? It knows who I am and knows where the money is. I can sell it. I know a house is not the same, but the fact is you can transfer assets easily within certain types of environments. And so when we talk about people accepting that blockchain, it's like, how would it affect real estate? I think that a lot of the things we see with title insurance and companies where title has changed and it lowers risk because we can see who owned it when, that's one thing. Now, on the other side, I think what you're getting to is, what if I created a piece of real estate in a virtual world? Could I own that? Would somebody be willing to buy that virtual space from me? Does it have a value? And I would say, to the degree that it's tied to something, yes. And you bring up the example, entertainment and sports, where they tie, and we've probably had this conversation before, instead of a baseball card, it is a digital baseball card of which the athlete only allowed 100 of them. There are only 100, all kind of like lithographs. And people can buy them, and that there are new ways to display them, and they're already selling for multi-millions of dollars. I would never buy one. I know they don't. I'm not their audience. But so there are kids today that are buying, where I used to buy baseball cards, they're buying NFTs and all of the, where you can combine. We maybe talked about this. Take a Disney movie, like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Take every frame of every Disney movie, and if you could authenticate that frame and you could limit the number of authentic frames and then sell them, there's a market. Becky, you know this. Somebody's going to make a market around that, and then they're going to create a way to display it. I got the one up. You know when Snow White gets kissed by the that one, there's only 100 of those. I can authenticate that. I bought it for $100,000, but it's worth $250,000. I wouldn't buy it. I'm not the audience. Right? So this whole thing is changing. Could it be real estate? It could. It's a ways off, I think. But I don't rule that out, where those types of intangible assets have value. And that's separate and apart from the technology that allows it to happen.
Well, so what I – and thank you – the clarification point I want to make there is Inland owns a lot of real estate. We've owned real estate in different parts, development and such. Physical addresses in existence in a virtual world. Do I own that? Is that going to be mine because I own the property that I can exchange either as part of the asset? When I sell the asset, that goes to the new owner, part of a right of ownership, riparian rights, excuse me, data, mineral. Oil rights on properties, commercially, residentially. I don't think it's that far off. If the world is really going to go into this universe and the spinoff of...
Well, even without going into that, dividing property rights up and being able to sell them, that has always happened, and that's going to continue to happen, I think. And they're probably, Jonathan, you probably put together groups that bought a whole bunch of mineral oil and gas rights in Oklahoma that produce so much revenue, and then people buy that because they buy revenue streams.
So that becomes the big question. Maybe Mark
Andreas
from marketing and capital markets. Go ahead.
Please. Think about it. We've seen it. Does your website transfer with your property? When someone buys a property, do they buy the website that has that address?
Yes.
They negotiate for it.
They negotiate for it. The intellectual property that's associated with it. Right. Because nobody wants to own a proper, like own the property, but not have the marketing piece that is part of it. That's considered part of the asset, the brand that goes along with it. So I think that's like the tip of the iceberg and that's the beginnings. But that's been going on for at least, 15, 20 years that those are transferring, that they're negotiating for transfer with it. So that's like, that was like the beginning of it.
Yeah.
We're seeing it.
You have to ask for it. But if you take a parcel based picture of the United States where you've got every single parcel, and anybody could do this if they had the assets and resources. I take a parcel, every parcel. And then underneath every parcel, I just start putting all kinds of data that's associated with that parcel. Who owns it? I do. The property owner doesn't own it. If I'm the one that created this parcel capability and started buying and putting data in there, I own that. Now, what if I said to the world, now that I own this, all of the people that would like to contribute to my database, tell me more about this house. Tell me more about this property. As a matter of fact, if you do it, if it ever gets used anywhere, you'll get paid for it. Why will you get paid for that? Because it's data. It's in a blockchain type of technology. And so you got people that are doing these things. So the question from, you're right, Becca, property owner, might I, should I be, should I not be? Does it matter? What are the rights that go with my property? I get airspace rights and I get mineral oil and gas rights and maybe I get data rights. Right now, just like anything, if you don't negotiate for it, you don't get it.
And I would offer up, Andre, it first occurred to me 20 years ago when CoStar gathered all the data. And then what they did was take everybody's data, put it into a computer, and then sell it back to me at outrageous prices. You know, Inland and, every other 10,000 commercial property owners out there. So I'm scratching my head. I say, wait a minute. I don't mind paying a reasonable amount for information, but I think they have the market out there basically, and they've always crushed the competition. So anyway, I guess you guys are carrying it to a further height for the main amount of data out there and gathering it and selling it. Who owns it?
You make a great point. Just think of that data. It's not only the property, it's like, what is the composition of the roof? When was the roof last replaced? What is it made out of, straw, bricks, or whatever? And that information is valuable to certain contractors who would want to know. And so there's this all this value that comes from the information that you provide or that brokers provide to whoever. And that's what takes a broker, trades that for that data for advertising, and then these companies take it and turn it into multi-billions of dollars. Right, by being able to parcel it up and then sell it, the insurance industry. Yep. And so the creator of this, the broker, the agent, the people that are actually out there collecting this data, the way an MLS should work is when you put your data into a multiple listing service, you should get paid because that data is going to go out and get utilized by a lot of people who are going to make a lot of money around that. And I think maybe we'll get there someday. We're just not there yet, right? We're just starting to get this awareness of the value of the data and how we were talking a couple of shows ago, I think, Andres, about somebody wearing something when they walked around a construction site and it measured how much and what, and they could figure out the shortcuts and they say, well, who would want to wear something like that? Well, I would if you paid me to wear it, maybe. So there's all these new ways to collect this data and always new ways to carve it up, and it's worth money. But if you've never been able to sell it before, it's like anything. If you never had it before, you don't really realize its value. And so you give it away. And that's kind of where we find ourselves, I think, in all areas of the real estate. You got these giant companies, whether it's CoStar on the commercial side or Zillow or Open Door, right? These giant companies making all this money off the collection of data that's provided by people basically at no cost.
Right.
What CoStar pays for building for structures, they do get for free on the resident side. The residential agents and homeowners, everybody just puts it up there. And the MLS, not the MLS, but Zillow and others, only because you brought up Zillow and we have to go there now. slow with their home buying, iBuying. They found data, they capitalized on other data, they grew their business, and they said, I want to move over and become a broker. I'm going to buy and sell, and I'm going to flip with that data. And they had the data, they knew they had it, and then they tried to do something with it, but it didn't work out that well.
Well, see, I don't think they became a broker because they wanted to become a broker, right? I was intimate with how they got their data in the first place, right? So at the time, there were two companies. There was a company called ListHub, and there was a company called Point2. And both ListHub and Point2 got data from multiple listing services, took that data and normalized it and provided it to anybody who wanted it, Zillow being one of the parties that wanted it. And so ListHub was purchased by Realtor.com. Realtor.com was a big competitor of Zillow early on, still is, right? And so what's the best way to start to choke a company? Buy their oxygen. And the oxygen for these portals was listing data. And so Realtor.com bought ListHub, and I was involved with Point2, and we had created this whole syndication just as ListHub. We were working with ListHub, was a separate company, and then we sold Point2. Point2 got sold to a big property management, the software development company called Yardi. And so Yardi bought Point2 and then gave that sold that syndication piece to ListHub, which was owned by Realtor.com. So now Realtor.com has the complete access, a source of the listing data that Zillow depended on, was now owned by Realtor.com. Realtor.com then turned off the spigot. And so how do you get data for your site when you're a portal? And it's very, and there are different ways to get it in different data licenses. And the one they finally got down to is the easiest way to get the data is to become a broker in 50 states, join all the MLSs, get an IDX feed. And now you've got all, that's what you have. But people don't realize this. Now they're a broker. Their site's not a neutral kind of consumer site anymore. It's a brokerage site. And they became a broker so that they could get the data feed, because all brokers can get the data feed. Before, when there was syndication, before ListHub, Realtor.com owned the syndication channels, they would get it from these syndication companies. Realtor.com bought the syndication companies, turned off the data, and forced Zillow into becoming a broker. That's how they became a broker. Now, as a broker, what do they decide to do? They decide that one of the ways to make money is there's so much commission in a real estate deal. There's so much cost and expense that if you can just buy the property direct, you can cut out, you can make a lot of money. And besides, they were the company, and Realtor's been telling them for years that there's estimates all messed up. So people, consumers would go there, and we all came to the conclusion that consumers didn't care about accuracy. They would just go to see what it was worth. And so Zillow got this big population of people just going there to see what the property wasn't accurate. They become a broker, all of a sudden they think they should get in the business. Now, Realtor's been telling them for years, your data's not very accurate. And so what do? They become an iBuyer. They go out there and they start buying these properties up, and they buy so many of them, and then they buy high and sell low. And so they were buying high and selling low. And they got to the point where they were too backed up. They had to stop everything. First they said, we're going to slow down. Then they said, we're going to stop everything. And then they laid off, they said, 25% of their workforce. Now, and they don't have much of a balance sheet. So if you lay off, what happens? Why did they lay off 25%? Was 25% of the workforce really tied up in iBuying? I don't know, but I wouldn't think so. I would think when you are taking that big of a hit, you have to, which were your biggest expense? Your employees. So they chopped 25%. That's amazing that they had to do that. 25% of their workforce. Why? Because they were buying high and selling. Jonathan, amazing. They're buying high and selling, right? Just, and so now everybody's talking about, how did they get in this position? Well, it's kind of ironic. If they were using their own methodology to determine value, maybe that's part of the problem.
Well, they had the data. They came, you could say that they came from the other side. They had the data and tried to be a broker. Instead of being a broker, giving away the data, paying Coaster for data, or marketing the data and pushing it out there, and they got into trouble. So the point I would make with why they're there is the disconnect between the data and the workforce, and then that's the people they were using. The data is never fully accurate because it's not qualitative; it's quantitative based on what's there. There isn't the human element isn't there. The qualitative analysis. the ability to understand the nuances in zoning, not just what isn't there. So I don't, iBuying is a working model in today's market because there's not enough access.
Well, so it depends. See, their model of iBuying was buy, I guess, was buy and flip. Well, I've never been a buy and flip person, right? So it was buy and flip. They were in, wrapped into this thing, I guess, where they believe with all this appreciation, buy and flip. Now, iBuying, I believe, is still right there. You take somebody like BlackRock, big company, Upland, companies that, right? No, if you're buying and hold it, and that's your, and so when I, there are iBuyers out there that aren't buying to flip. They're buying to hold it. Or, and in some cases, they're even building it as rental property to begin with. And that whole other issue, right? Availability and affordability. But that's what's happening. So, so their model, their iBuyer model didn't work because they were trying to sell it too soon after they bought it. But then you've got these big institutional, I call them, see, that's what I think an iBuyer is. It's an institutional buyer. It's not an instant buyer, I guess.
I don't think, John, that would make Inland is an iBuyer, but I wouldn't call them an iBuyer.
Well, iBuyers, these institutions buying up all these, and it's okay. That's what they do. And they put together investment groups, big ones, little ones, and they buy. And now they're buying single family homes, right? And condos, and so that it so it affects the supply. But that's what's happening today.
I think it was call. Andreas, do you remember the last call? I think is where we discovered that we had all defined iBuyer differently in our heads. We all had a completely different definition of what iBuyer was.
Yeah.
Now that you've brought that up, yes.
So what they said about Zillow, because they said all the headlines are their iBuyer. Well, that's one type of iBuyer, the one that tries to buy it and sell it right away. But there are other giant institutions that are iBuyers that come in and cash you out, buy your property for cash, and they're iBuyers too. But it's a different investment, just like anything. It's, you know, buy it and sell it, or buy it and hold it. And there are investor groups that were, and Zillow was one that was buying to sell. And I think Opendoor, their big competitor, I think they're a buy and sell model, but they're also buy and hold models. And those are great models because they make money and they get to a point where they got cash flow and people love them.
Like a car wash, and I bought in 1980.
Bought 1979.
John, I was close. I get credit for close. John, what is with all that's being bought up with Inland? What is the strategy there? Is it buy and hold, or do you repackage fast and just securitize all of it?
Well, on a 1031, we buy and hold, and as we know, real estate is not real liquid. We keep it until there's an opportunity, depending on the marketplace, to sell it. Our 1031s, for instance, we've sold in 2 years, which is pretty quick. Other deals have lasted 10, 12 years because the market wasn't right, depending on whatever the product was. And we had to wait it out. Investors had to wait it out. That's one of the things we tell everybody who goes into real estate. It is not a liquid investment unless you're on it's traded with the REITs. Those are liquid, but typically tell people that. So we're
and Beck, with all the stories you're telling across the nation for your companies, what's the strategy marketing wise, buy and hold investment wise? What's going on your side as we go over this?
So it's interesting that you asked that because it occurs to me having this conversation today, I don't know if I've ever worked with like with a flipper. Like my old company had an instance where we had purchased a land property and suddenly somebody came and asked if they could buy it. And we're like, okay, sure, I guess. Yeah, I guess we can. Like, but it was never an intentional flip scenario because when people are long-term professional investors, they recognize the illiquidity of commercial real estate as an investment. And it's well understood that there is a time piece to this. Even the funds that we're seeing our partners and our various investors, and we have clients right now raising over $100 million in funds between the different clients that I have that are right now in fundraising process. And every single one of them has a hold strategy that's at least 5 years. Because maybe there are within their documents some ability to sell before then if there's a wonderful market for it. But traditional real estate investing is meant to be a long-term play, at least in my experience.
But the opposite of my definition of high buyer.
Part of what they believed was they could cut that the costs of buying and selling were so great that you could go in, buy it, eliminate the buy side expenses, the commissions, and then when you sell it and you don't pay the same. So there was in their structure, part of this profit was going to come from the sale. Not to mention, if a new buyer came in, you could get the finance piece. And you throw that finance piece on there. So there are all these pieces that they, so buying and selling, just the transactional costs were part of their revenue model. It just didn't work the way they thought it would. And it usually doesn't when you buy high and sell low.
I feel like that's like a private seller mentality, like the individual home buyer, like I'll make more money if I eliminate the broker, like eliminate the broker and everything's hunky dory.
Well, that's what Zillow wanted to do. That's it. That was their, right? And so they're in trouble now, right? And it looks like they're in more trouble than if you think that 25% of a workforce is a big piece, right? And the 25, I just can't imagine that 25% was their iBuyer. It had to be, it was all these, so people that had nothing to do with the iBuyer program, I bet, got laid off.
I'm sure.
Right? Because they had all these losses, and if you don't have lots, remember, they're not a company that is in profit, makes money, a lot of money every year. So they're still kind of struggling with that. And as Michael Dilpreet used to kid that they had, you know, companies like this, public companies, unlimited assets, and that's what brokers have to compete with today, companies with unlimited assets. But maybe there's a lesson here, right?
Tread carefully. Yeah. And surround yourself with smart people is always a good lesson. Although Zillow was thought to be pretty smart, though we all, if you did read their term on that estimate, I think it said 15 to 30% error was what they said that was the swing, what they proclaimed. They said 15 to 30% off.
That's a heck of a swing.
If I showed up in England to pitch a deal and I said I got 30% swing in my numbers,
yeah,
he'd laugh me out.
Ask anybody if there's a 30% swing.
Well, in any real estate transaction where you make where your underwriting is to not pay professional advisors in the process, that you're underwriting your own risk in the transaction is a very risky thing to do. You can only underwrite your own risk so much. And when they're using that in a scale mentality of over and over and over again, eliminating professionals in the transaction, not wanting to compensate the people who know what they're doing. And they find
In their mind, kind of think about it. In their mind, they're a broker. Right? Because they're a broker, they're licensed in the state, and they've got to have people that are handling this for them. Who, if their license is required, a license is required. So, I mean, they might have thought they're doing this all right. that's part of it, and we know this to be the case, where there, if you look at everybody wants to bring the cost down in transactions, and the only way you bring the cost down is you eliminate the number of times a transaction is touched by a human being. And so, to the degree that you can take the human being touches out of the transaction, you're going to reduce the costs. But to what degree can you do that and maintain an efficient and effective transaction? And that's what they haven't figured out.
Well, I don't think anyone's figured that out. Nor will it.
Don't you think they'll figure it out? I mean, commissions, like, you just take the real estate commission. It's 5 to 6%. It's always been 5 to 6%. It doesn't matter how automated we are, it's 5 to 6%. It doesn't matter if it's a $500,000 house or a $5 million house, it's 5 to 6%. Now, the DOJ, look, they say something's wrong with that. It just can't always be that way. There's got to be something going on here, whether or not it's intentional or otherwise. And remember, with antitrust laws, the or otherwise is just as good as intentional is. And so they're looking at those things now. And so you're going to see, I continue to see this squeeze on commissions, and they're going to come down. And that's why companies are buying companies and they're trying to do all these different things. And they think, oh, maybe I'll flip properties to make money. And right, and some of these things will work and some of them won't work. But we continue to believe that costs are going to come down in real estate transactions. And if you believe that, you'll look for alternative sources of revenue, and then you'll survive and you come through this. And right, and the people that don't pay any attention to this, I think are going to have a hard time with it.
Good point.
Well, I don't think it's 5 or 6% on bigger deals, frankly.
Oh, yeah, right.
I mean, it can go down to 1% depending on how big the deal is. And people look at the dollar amount that you're going to make on it and subtract your expenses, putting everything together and your manpower. And so a huge deal can be 1%.
Yeah. Yeah, on the residential side, pretty much still the same, right? It doesn't change. It just stays
yeah.
the same.
So especially a million and below.
Yeah.
Because you got two people and two companies splitting everything up. So at the end of the day, you know, it's one of the things, you know, you, Becca, started to talk about it, you know, of the devaluing of the broker and what a broker brings in expertise to the deal and juggles all the balls to keep everybody on track to get the thing done with the brokers, with the other brokers, the lawyers, the banks, et cetera. So, yeah, the brokers have always had, especially with owners, you know, I think they look at brokers as a necessary evil. You know, they think brokers make big commissions. Well, sometimes they do, but they don't talk about the other deals that took a year and a half to get done, and you wound up making $10 an hour on at the closing. So, because it lasted so long and you put so much time into it.
Or you got nothing. You worked for 2 years on it. You got nothing.
Right, that happens too.
Yeah.
The deal flames out.
Exactly. The first thing I built when I was building out my teams, residentially and commercially, was the client worth calculator. I should share this on the show. I'll find it somewhere. And you plug in the deal value and your overhead and a few other things, variables, and it would spit back out you how many hours you could spend on that client. If you've been doing this for any period of time, you can judge by the person how many hours that's going to take, plus the background. How taxing is the relationship going to be? And we used to turn down deals all the time because we don't know. We know how long this should take. But we know you're going to personally take another 50 hours of my time. So we're making a judgment call because there's a lot of deal. There was a lot of pain in figuring.
Right.
Out.
Or the owner wants.
I should have walked away on.
Yeah. But the other side of that.
Absolutely.
Is the other side of that is that person might be the person that introduces you to somebody that provides you with a really big.
That was not in the spreadsheet.
Exactly. That's the human side, right?
That's the human side.
Yeah, that's the human side. Yep. That's the side you can't account for with Zillow eye buying. You know, it's a big deal. And I can't believe we're already coming up on the top of the hour here. We jumped to Brown Bed. That's mostly my fault. But Saul, we went through step one. We did our introductions. Jonathan, we went to step two. We talked about the market and all that's happening, and it's dizzying. I think Rebecca, you agree. Marketing itself, it's just all dizzy. And then step three of the show every month is we talk about what people should be doing to do better in their business in a succinct way. And/or car wash for Saul. So it's the top of the hour. We covered data ownership, what it may or may not look like, but just know that it's valuable. Try to figure out how valuable. And from my side of the fence, be wary of your data, too much data paralysis. What, from your side, Saul, do you have for the audience, for the industry, after this month, after this chat? What's your takeaway the last 30 days?
Well, I think things are going to – well, I'm waiting for NAR. I want to see the success of the people meeting again at NAR. But I think that that's going to give me some indication of how fast people will start to get out and start to move again. And what can somebody do for themselves? Best thing they can do for themselves, I think, you set up an educational program where you start to pay attention to things that you don't think you need to pay attention to. And so this area of, well, we're interested in data. Let's be real interested in, and we don't need to understand it completely, but let's be real interested in blockchain technology and how that might apply to the real estate industry and how that might affect you down the road and just what that means without understanding the technology itself. So I would say start to pay attention to when you hear the words, when you hear blockchain, when you hear cryptocurrency, when you hear NFTs, when you hear those words, just start to pay a little bit of attention and it will pay off in the long run.
And Jonathan, what pearl of wisdom do you have for the audience over the last 30 days, over the last 40 minutes talking back and forth with us?
Well, I would continue on with the basics that this is a contact sport, relationship building, and opportunities are out there if you keep working them. And, you know, the old adage, the harder you work, the luckier you get, I think is true.
It sounds like nobody's a family spreadsheet here with the client too many hours, but that's okay. It worked well. Back at last 40 minutes, what's your take for the industry?
So commercial real estate is a long-term investment. Whether that's in our relationships, these are long-term investments, the long-term of our relationships with each other, with our other colleagues and friends in the industry, the people that you're going to see at NAR, Saul, the people that I'm going to see at ICSC in December, and Jonathan will also see at ICSC in December because he also just booked his ticket. Real estate itself is a long-term investment. And if there's one thing that we have all learned, it's that we can't view the people and the pieces of our processes as that quick flip. We all know that, look, we're all lifers here. That's a reality here. All of us, we are lifers in this industry. It is our passion. It is what we do. Every nuance and every aspect to it. And viewing it with a little bit broader mentality versus the get-rich-quick schemes are really what have sustained us throughout every economic cycle that we have seen. And some of you guys have seen more than I have, but I've tried to catch up. So for those who are in real estate, keep an eye on the prize. It's a long-term investment.
I will echo that. I like the life statement. I think that everybody, every transient person who tunes in this call, who isn't quite sure about being in real estate, should realize that the takeaway I got from the call in iBuyer is to not dabble. If you're in real estate, as Saul pointed out, be in real estate and understand it. Even if you don't understand all of it, commit to mastery and understanding how it all works. And if that's the case, please continue to watch the show. If not continue to watch the show, you just learn more. But in addition to that, and even Jonathan touched on it, it's a contact sport. So if you can't commit time and the resources to Becca's point and be a lifer, you're not going to ever see the full value of it, let alone what the data will be or won't be in the metaverse or commercial verse. Trademarked, I think. I want that one. In the commercial verse property. How to find you, Sal? How did they find you? What can you offer?
Yeah, you can go to realtown.com. We're bringing it back. We decided we needed a content management system again. So we're bringing Realtown back. And right in the middle of it, it says the Data Advocate. So you follow us on our blog, The Data Advocate. There you go, thedataadvocate.com. Or you can find us on Realtown, or you can find me. You can send me an email, saul@bettercallsaul.realtor.
Love it. And Becca, how do they find you? Why do they find you? What can offer that?
So we need more stories to tell. We need more stories to tell. Carlson Integrated, my team of marketing mavens, is very excited about our new clients that are coming in, and we're excited for new clients that we still have yet to meet. I'm reachable there, 224-338-9855, or Becca, B-E-K-A-H, at carlsonintegrated.com.
Jonathan, why do we? Why are we reaching you? What? What are you bringing to
the- I don't have any fancy graphics to throw up there, but my email is JJ, the two letters, at inlandgroup.com. And my phone anytime, 630-218-4949. And thank you very much, Andreas. That's terrific. I love it.
Vegan actually, is awesome.
That's got to go to Mendoza Productions and background. I don't know if he'll join to say goodbye and what he brings and how he brings.
Thank you.
As far as he is. Yay!
Bye, everyone. Yeah. Just doing the things behind
the studio and all the mastering back there. As far as finding me, you can always reach out. You can always meet me on Twitter, Andreas W. Senny, or reach my Google Voice number, those that don't know, 203-584-7257. It's a person mission driving technology enablement into organizations so they can flourish and thrive. It's my passion alongside real estate technology. That's where I live. That's where I've thrived. And thanks to that, I've met all of you. And we've done a lot of good things. And this is just one of them. So looking forward to seeing you again next week. For Jonathan Stein there, something to point out for the listening, green energy. If you have a green property, if you could use CBA solar financing. I know you and I touched on it. I think it's something we didn't get to talk about here, but hopefully we'll talk about with Inland in the future.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone.